All right, I think we'll start this meeting, and hopefully everyone had an uneventful drive to the Capitol today and kind of slippery road throughout. And we do have, we don't quite have a quorum. We have five. Oh, yes, we do. So why don't we take minutes first? Do we have some minutes? Right here. Do I hear a motion to approve the February 22nd minutes? Representative Demmer moves to approve of the February 22nd, 2008 minutes. Any discussion on that? Not, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Krakowski, you are here first. And I think with that, we're going to reward you for your promptness. And so, with that, we have House File 3336. And Representative Dietrich, would you like to move that for possible inclusion into a possible omnibus property tax bill? All right, we have that moved. And welcome to the committee. I know that's the first time this committee. You're probably a first time to a lot of committees as you're hearing, Joe. So welcome.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and representatives, everybody, I assume, has a copy of the bill and the fiscal note and the House research summary. This is a bill that the idea really materialized from discussions with folks in my district, especially those senior citizens that... those senior citizens that are on fixed incomes. So I've probably received phone calls and one-on-one discussions from people, probably a dozen to 20 different individuals, almost independently came up with the same sort of idea in my discussions with them, and that was, what can we do to limit the upward mobility of property taxes, especially for seniors, and again it was targeted to those people, or came from those people who are on fixed incomes and struggling because they were limited and actually seeing a shrinking level of disposable income in their household budgets. So what this bill does is it locks in the valuation of the property for seniors when they reach 65 years old, and it would kick into place if it's an individual living in the house, it would kick into place when that individual reached 65, or if it was a couple, it would kick into place when the second of the two spouses reached 65 years old. That's really the gist of the bill. As soon as the property is sold or transferred, the valuation for property tax purposes would return to the normal value, or if it loses its homestead classification, it would also return to the normal value. Those are the ways that I guess it expires on the particular property. It's tied to the homestead status of that property, so it's the either the home they're living in, or for the farmstead classification, the home and garage and 1 acre piece. That's really the outline of the bill. I see it as a way to help seniors stay in their homes and increase and maintain the quality of life, so that they don't have to move into some sort of other housing arrangements that aren't their own. And I would expect it may in the long term provide us some savings in social services costs, it will allow seniors the ability to plan for the future with that, again, that fixed income that they have. Also, one thing, I guess, as I've talked to people recently about this bill, one of the suggestions that people have had is, you know, you might want to put in some sort of income limits. You know, the point was, you know, Carl Pollard probably doesn't need to have this this in place, that type of thing. I'd certainly be willing to take a look at something like that. The fiscal notes, there's you know, the homestead credit would be reduced, or would be increased, and the property tax refunds reduced for a net of about $1 million increase to the state over a biennium. So that's about the cost to the state, according to the Department of Revenue folks. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative. I think Representative Demmer, you were first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drashkowski, I think you've hit on something we've been talking about here for a while, and that's the senior. We've been throwing this around. Would it be your intention that do I have to live in the house? First of all, would it be your intention that if I'm 63 today and 3 years from now when I turn 65, it locks? Is that the way it would work?
Right.
Is that
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I continue?
Yep, you bet.
And so, do I have to live for any certain amount of time? If I buy the house and I'm 64, the next year, does it lock in place?
Representative Kelsey.
Mr. Chair and committee, yes, the way the bill is written, yes, it locks in place. And the movement to age 65 is what triggers the lock in value.
Mr. Representative Demmer.
I think that's all good. You know, what we're after, I think, and we've struggled with this, I think, in this committee and probably even in the past, is some sort of way to not price people out of their homes because of taxes. I think that's what we're after, and I think we've all kind of agreed with that. Did you look at all about, rather than working on things like we're looking at income, which is problematic for assessors. They don't like to have to look at people's income and take that into consideration. It might just be problematic because there's a judgment in there someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Did you look at, and we also have had difficulty with playing with values, you know, the idea that the value is the value, and maybe we should look at different classes, you know, based on, or maybe just, you know, freezes on tax amounts or something like that. Did you have any discussion with anybody about that or dive into that? If you did, and if you didn't, that's fine too, but I was just wondering if you could give us any kind of insight into your thoughts on that, because it's something that many of us have thought about. And
Representative Drashkowski.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, I've had a little bit of discussion about the notion of taking a look at considering the value of the property as kind of a ceiling at some point, but really not any of those other elements that you had discussed.
Oh. Representative Demmer.
One more. Did I read too that the actual the valuation increase that happens after the 65, I think is listed someplace too, isn't it? On a tax form or was it in there someplace that that's listed?
Representative?
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, yes. If you're 66 years old and you're operating under this and you happen to build a deck on, the value of the deck is added to the valuation of the property. Is that where you're getting at?
Representative Demmer.
Yeah, I saw that, and that's a good point, too. But I guess more what I was thinking about, say, for example, I'm looking at purchasing a home from you. You're 70 years old. You've been locked into a valuation for 5 years. Would I be able to see from your tax statement what the true valuation is if you wouldn't have been 70 years old? In other words, that growth in the 5 years from 65 to 70, I think that I read someplace that growth is shown someplace, so I would know when I buy it what the taxable value is when I'm not 65.
Representative Drashkowski?
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, yes. As a matter of fact, both on the estimate of property tax statement and also on the actual statement, those two different values are represented as the bill's written now.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rockler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Kelsey. This is an area that we've wrestled with a lot. We do have a current program that I suspect you may have heard of, which is the Senior Citizen Property Tax Deferral Program. And I know seniors don't like the fact that after the property sold, the taxes get recovered. But I think the local governments appreciate the fact that they're made whole at some point here. But I wanted to point out to the committee, if we're going to consider this, that there, I think the cost is actually going to be more than the $730 million because there's some implications here for the Health and Human Services budget. And that, I don't know if you know, but two-thirds of the nursing home costs of people in nursing homes are paid for by the state and federal government through medical assistance. Most people don't have a lot of money necessarily saved up, and when they go into the nursing home and start paying $3,000 to $4,000 a month for those costs, it's pretty easy to deplete the family savings. And in determining your eligibility, they actually look at the value of your assets. And once you get to a point where you're not expected to return or you have a community spouse, they do look at the home value. So we need to kind of just figure out how that might work. And so just so you know that as we move forward, you might want to talk to some of the Health and Human Service staff just to kind of understand what the implications might be and whether you want to address that somehow. But I also wondered if we might want to explore something else. I brought in a bill last year, too, in my first year on Property Tax Division that had to do with adjusting the market value based on energy efficiency in new buildings, because the new buildings that I'm got going up in downtown Minneapolis, I was told by knowledgeable people the first thing they threw out as construction costs went up was the energy efficiency improvements, and that seemed like it's short-term thinking rather than long-term, and could we give them a credit so that they'd want to keep those, you know, better windows, better heating plants into the plan as they went about implementing it. And I was pretty much convinced by the assessors, and a few in the audience, that messing around with market value is something that they don't really want us to do. So, but there are other ways to do it, and I think Representative Demmer's given you some guidelines, and our staff is great at working with that on how to do it. But I did kind of learn my lesson with that bill last year, that I was convinced that we really ought to have the value be the value, and then we can forgive it, we can give it a different classification, we can do some other things. And so I just encourage you to, like me, learn all those other problems.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Just that fiscal note for 11-7 is $730,000.
Oh,
and the way you no, that's fine. after yesterday's forecast, we don't need to make this any more difficult. But
services is always a million.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Answer Representative Loeffler's concern. Yes, we do have the revenue estimate here, but we've also requested a fiscal note on the bill, and normally processing time for fiscal notes is a week, and we haven't allowed that span of time yet to occur, so we'll have a better idea of what some of the other costs to state agencies or state funds will be once that note is completed.
Thank you for bringing that up, Representative. Representative Piskowski, this has been a lot of debate, and states do this differently. There's a number of states that have certain provisions for seniors, and some don't. But it kind of comes down to what you really are trying to accomplish. I mean, is it just at a certain age? Is it an age thing you're trying to accomplish, or is it a property tax relative to one's burden on one's income? And I think that's probably closer to what you're getting at, because like you said, the Carl Pohl ad, that's very arbitrary when you set that number. And so what Minnesota has done, and the approach we've taken, and I think with our debate last year, is with the property tax refund program, that is a program that provides refunds for those whose property taxes are high in proportion to their income. And looking at, and then that kind of gets to what you're saying. And my question would be to you, how would this benefit, if we were just to look at 65, do you think that would be better, or would it be better to ratchet up the property tax refund program, which really gets to the income portion? Or do you see still some advantage in going just with, once you hit the age, regardless of your income, that still should be a market value freeze?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I really haven't thought a lot about that. I guess the first thing that comes to mind is that there's a certain segment of the population that doesn't apply for that refund. That's probably one of the downsides to having it deferred to having to go get the refund. But other than that, I really haven't considered that. Really, the intent is yes, it's to to help people who have a shrinking level of disposable income as gas prices and food prices and other costs of living continue to consume that, especially those folks. Well, I mean, we're talking specifically about those folks who are on fixed incomes. You know, let's face it, the quality of life is improved when people can extend the amount of time in which they can live in their own home.
Representative Demme. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a question. Mr. Chair, was the PTR, is that a refundable credit? In other words, if I say, for example, I can't recall. Was the PTR set up as a refundable credit where I would get the money back whether I had enough income to cover it or not? Like for the rent or for the real estate tax portion?
Well, Representative Demmer, and someone can correct me, you would never have more refund than what your property taxes would be on the PTR.
So, wasn't the PTR set up where if your property taxes were so high, you'd get credit on your income tax?
No.
It wasn't that way?
No, that would be...
What was that?
Oh, well, that one time then.
I'm not near enough.
Well, maybe, Ms. Baker, maybe you want to answer that, because that goes... I didn't even know it went off income.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Demmer, when you file for a property tax refund, like the chair said, you're looking at your property tax and your income and looking at the schedule, and that gives you what your actual refund is, and that's just a refundable amount that is sent to you separate from your income tax. It used to be years ago that you filed it along with your income tax. Oh, I was 15 years old. I kind of forgot about that.
Yeah.
But that was many years ago. So, yes, I mean, it is a refundable credit. But, I mean, it's more of a refund. We just don't think of it as a credit because it really is just a refund for property taxes.
Thank you. I was thinking of the wrong mechanism there. That makes more sense, actually. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other comments on this? One other little thing to throw into the mix on all of this is, of course, the market value is only one part of things because you still have the city and county and school and township tax rates. That's still to drive that up. So,
Mr. Kirk,
as
I thought about putting this bill together and talked with research staff, it seemed as if you started to consider both elements of those and putting some sort of limit on, it became more complicated. And it seemed much easier and much cleaner to really focus on the valuation rather than the combination of the two. The rate end seemed to be problematic, if that's helpful.
Any other comments? Is there anyone who cares to testify for or against House File 3336? If not, Representative Dietrich renews her motion to lay over House File 3336 for possible inclusion into a property tax relief bill. So, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of the Committee.
Thank you. A couple announcements here, and I need to go, but our next meeting is Wednesday, March 5th. It's a hearing at the Minneapolis North High School, and there's no transportation being provided. So if there's, but we can carpool. Are they to contact you?
Yep.
So if anyone's interested, contact Sarah, and we can carpool over there also. So that, the intent was to hold 8 of these, and we've held 6, and it was 2 in rural Minnesota, 2 in the regional centers, 2 in the suburbs, and then 1 in Minneapolis and St. Paul, 1 in each, for a total of 8. So this would be the 7th one. So if you can make it, that would be great. I think we'll probably have a pretty good attendance there. Anything else I need to do before I go? Oh, yes. We will not be hearing House File 50. So that one has been pulled. So anyone here for House File 50 will not be doing that. So I'm going to turn this over to Vice Chair Representative Brown, and I want to wish everyone a very nice weekend if I'm not back. So thank you.
The next bill for consideration will be House File 957, Representative Zeller. And I'll move that bill to get it before the committee. Welcome, Representative Zeller. Would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. And thank you for consideration. I can tell you from the drive-in today, our Minnesota Highway Patrol is doing an excellent job of maintaining our roads. I saw four of them behind four accidents from Maple Grove to St. Paul. So my apologies to committee members for late arrival. Madam Chair, members, the bill before you is yet again, this is what happens when you go outside and start listening to your neighbors. This is another, probably the second biggest concern I've had from neighbors, especially senior citizens in my area. The original idea of the legislation is, as Chair Marquardt had said, that different states do this, and a fishing buddy of mine who lives here in Minnesota during the summers and then vacations down in Texas was telling me about how Texas had addressed the senior population who had lived in their house all their life and wanted to stay in their house. You can see by the bill, and it's similar to Representative Zarkowski's bill, and I don't have his bill in front of me, but I've made the parameters a little bit narrower. I tried to turn the qualifiers just a little bit tighter so that we're looking at truly the a low to medium income, and these are lifetime residents of their house. So the qualifiers are that they're 65 and older. If they're a married couple, both of them have to be 65 or older. Household income is $60,000, and then they've had to have lived in the house. At least one of the residents has had to have lived in the house for 25 years. So this is truly keeping some of our senior citizens who have retired and are in fixed income in their original homes. And the one other, what I'd consider a local option or local control component is that the counties, that only the counties who approve it are the ones available. So that's my bill, Madam Chair and members. You've had a discussion about Representative Zarkowski's bill, so I won't go on and on. I think you've talked a little bit about the bill and the process and what we're trying to address here, but I would feel free to open it up for questions. You do see the fiscal note starts in 2011, and for those, again, counties that choose to enroll in the program. And I do not believe, I don't think a testifier that was going to be here was able to make it because of either traffic or out of town, so.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Zeller. I just wanted to explore a little bit this concept of rewarding longevity in the same house. And particularly as people age, I don't know if that's such a good value. I know it addresses the issue of people who don't try and, quote, hide assets so they can qualify for medical assistance or something else by buying a bigger house or that kind of thing. I guess it has that good policy value. But at the same time, at least in our community, we're actually encouraging seniors who are living in big four-bedroom homes that they raised their family to think about moving into something smaller, dramatically reducing the cost of living, which is, I think, the goal here by reducing, you know, the heating bill. Maybe going to something that has a first-floor bathroom, which is not typical of the large family homes that were built in the 1900s, early 1900s, which is, you know, kind of more the area time my community was developed. And so if you could just tell us a little bit more about why you felt like we should reward longevity or why you thought that was a control factor we should think about.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the two constituent groups, four constituents, two different families that I talked to, had said, you know, we want to stay where, you know, our home is, but once we're on fixed income, one was a retired teacher, one was a retired postal worker, said, you know, our income is right on the borderline, and I think they may have actually been just a little bit above at $68,000 or $69,000, what it was. But with the longevity now of the baby boomers looking at, you know, maybe a 90-plus, my grandpa's a good example. He's 91 and just entered a home 2 years ago. His home, you're correct, was modified so that he had a downstairs bathroom, shower, everything on the first floor level. But, you know, we found that he was much more comfortable with his neighbors who were still there. The grandchildren, usually in a lot of cases, are still in the same community. The children and grandchildren are still in the same community. And in some cases, one of the constituents I talked to, they do the babysitting or the daycare for the grandchildren, for their children, for their grandchildren. So they have maybe a little bit extra space for a playroom or, you know, a coloring room, whatever it may be. But that the space at this point in time was still needed for, you know, their family being around. There, especially in my community, there's a lot of single floor, as you can imagine, there's lots of construction up our area. But there are a lot of single level townhomes and condominiums that are being built. But in a lot of cases, you know, 65 is the new 55 or the new 50. But that's nearly, for some folks, just getting started. So to stay in their original home for another 10, 15, maybe even 20 years is not going to be unheard of. And with the baby boomer generation, maybe it's even longer than that. But just so that folks can stay with an asset that they've also had, that they've now paid off at a longer point in time as well.
Are there any other questions? Are there anyone from the audience who wants to testify? Representative Zillers, do you have any closing comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. Like I said, I think you had a good discussion with Representative Zarkowski, so I won't prolong the discussion. And again, thank you for indulging the traffic rules this morning.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion to move the bill, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion in the property tax.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, have a good weekend.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Earhart, you have a bill.
Thank you.
Representative Earhart, would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we're looking at House File 2348. We have an amendment here, and if it's okay, I'd like to move House File H2348A1 amendment. Basically, what that does is change the date in the kind of a technical amendment, I suppose, brings the bill up to date.
All those in favor of getting the bill into the shape that the author would like it? Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And then would you speak to your bill, please?
Thank you. What we have here is a bill that would create a new property tax refund for owners of non-commercial seasonal recreational property. Same as you already have this on your residential homestead. I think it's called the circuit breaker. Am I correct on that? Yes, no? Yes, it's called the circuit breaker, and what it says is if the disparity between your income and your property taxes are at a certain degree, on a sliding scale, you get a refund up to a maximum amount from the state. I think that would be it, essentially. Now, we're suggesting that the same thing be applied to seasonal and recreational property. Actually, the refund would be based on the same schedule used to determine the current homeowner property tax refund as to income and valuation and property tax amounts. It phases out at incomes of $96,300. And the maximum refund for eligible claimants would be approximately $1,800. There are 115,000 non-commercial seasonal recreation properties, and about 25% of all residential homesteads currently claim a homeowner property tax refund. It is assumed in the revenue analysis that 20% of seasonal recreation property owners would claim a refund, as lower income homeowners would be less likely to own a second home. So the average net tax on a seasonal recreation property is 38% lower than the average net tax on a residential property. So the assumption that they make in the revenue note is that the average property tax refund for a seasonal rec property would be 38% lower, or approximately $400. So you have the revenue note there, no charges in 08 or 09, but in 2010 and 2011, they're looking at $9.2 million and $9.7 million respectively. They think the number of taxpayers involved here would be about 28,800. And I have a witness here with me.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, and I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. And we support this bill. One of our positions has been that a house is a house. And I know that a lot of times people look at cabin owners as people who, well, you can afford two homes, well, then you can afford the taxes on two homes. And that's not really the case. The average seasonal owner in Minnesota has a household income of about $60,000 by our last, about the state average. It's not a whole lot different. And this bill actually looks at the income and focuses the relief where it's needed. So the people that don't fit that model of the wealthy cabin owner that are going to lose their places would be getting this relief, and so we support it for that reason.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair and members, this is generally I think that the fact that this, again, focuses on the individual taxpayer rather than on shipping the money to a government entity and hopes that they will reduce property taxes is where we should be going. It goes to the people who actually qualify for it rather than to a general broad-based local government aid, which may or may not affect those that really are in need. So that's why I think it's a good idea, just like we've done with our residential property tax.
Mm-hmm. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Earhart. I know we've, in our earlier meetings, we've gone through other bills to deal with the issues of seasonal recreational property owners. I think we have a wide range of kind of alternatives on the table now. My only comment would be if we were going to go into this kind of a refund program, I would definitely think we should look at I'd like to raise that part of it, but I think we ought to look more at what the limitations are on the rental property tax refund program. To have someone who has a second home eligible for a significant refund, dramatically higher than someone who doesn't have the advantages of increased equity, who's renting, which is right now lower than a homeowner, to allow a seasonal rec owner have higher property tax assistance than someone who's renting, I think would be a real inequity we'd have to wrestle with.
Well, Madam Chair, and Mr. Loeffler, there's no reason we can't introduce that bill. I think I might want to sign on for taking a look at it.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Forster, do we have any good data on how long the average seasonal property owner has owned the property versus regular residential in our state?
Mr. Forster.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, two sources. We did a study a few years back that looked at that, and we found that the average seasonal property has been in constant ownership for 25 years. According to the Census Bureau, for a home, it's about 7, I believe. And the Forest Service, in their effort to look at family forest landowners in the state, the Forest Service is becoming very concerned about fragmentation of forests and shorelands in the country. And so they've done a nationwide study. In Minnesota, more of our forest land and lakeshore is privately held than owned by either the state or the national forest, and it's being subdivided very quickly.
And they found that 25-year number as well. So the data jives. And it was interesting, your comment about renters versus seasonal property owners. We had our seasonal property, my wife and I, and we were renting when we first got it. It was, you know, the family dynamic happened and it was time to step up, and that's where we put our money first. I assume I'm not necessarily alone. You know, the idea that seasonal isn't paying its fair share, it is. We pay school taxes, we pay for all these services in these local communities that we don't use, and help support the renters in those communities that do use them. Where the problem is, I think, in the fairness issue is that we pay more. So on average, if seasonal property owners using their property about 5 weeks out of the year, if they're paying for a full year of school services that they can't use, they're paying for roads and everything else, and nobody's really complaining about that, but the idea that we pay more is, I just think it's unfair. And this bill, as Representative Earhart said, is a good one, I think, because it targets the relief to the people that need it. And that's a good thing, I think.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think that's a pretty significant statistic. If the average seasonal property has been in the same hands for 25 years versus 7 years in a regular residential. And, you know, a follow-up question to that would be, during that same 25-year period, what kind of increases have there been in valuations for seasonal recreational? Do we have any data on that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Lanning. They've been dramatic. In some cases, I've seen tax bill increases in the last few years of 123. We give a booby prize to the seasonal owner that sends us the tax bill with the biggest tax increase. And I see many, many, many bills that are 30% tax increase. The winner last year was 123% increase in tax bill. Land that was a few thousand dollars in, you know, 2000 is now hundreds of thousands of dollars. It depends on which lake you're on. There's certain lakes, and which is really insidious, because the lakes that are the most beautiful are the ones that are now called national market lakes. And so the more intense the pressure for development, the more intense the market value increases, the more people that have had this property for years and years and years can't afford to hold on to it. They sell it, it gets subdivided. And I believe the members of the committee that have been on the committee for a number of years remember the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency study of water quality and the link between a value of front foot. But what it states is that if you improve the clarity of a lake by 1 meter, the value of that land goes up, and I'm pulling off of memory here, but it's about $250 a front foot, I think. If you decrease the clarity of that lake by 1 meter, you lose about $500 a front foot. So if there's a financial incentive on a lake like Leech, we're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars, or Vermilion, which is the lake I'm on. The market value increases have been dramatic, more so than any other property class, I believe.
I think, Madam Chair, if someone was able to pull up that figure, you know, over the last 25 years, what has been statewide the increase in value of seasonal rec, I think we'd all be pretty much amazed at how, and I don't know what it is, but I'd like to know what it is, because it helps illustrate why seasonal rec is such an important issue to so many people. And you know, the fact of the matter is that that has enabled local property tax bases to grow by a substantial amount. And, you know, that's a good thing for the local governments, but but it's also resulted in skyrocketing taxes for the people who own the property and only use it for part of the year.
And Chair, would the tax folks, the property tax folks, have anything on that, or is that buried away in a dusty tome somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chairman, Representative Earhart, I don't have it with me, but we can certainly get the growth and seasonal rec property over 25 years quite easily. I can provide it to the great committee.
Are there other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Are there questions from the audience?
Oh.
Representative Earhart, would you like to make a closing comment?
No, I just, Madam Chair, I just hope we get some consideration on this. I don't know what biennium I was working on. Is that 2010 yet to be considered, or are we not concerned about that at the moment? That's the only, I can't remember where our, what we're balancing. Are we going to 10, 11, or are we just balancing 09 in the current?
09.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, then I think there's certainly possible consideration for this if we're not doing anything to this biennium.
Thank you. I lay over House File 2348 for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Committee report. Thank you. Okay, just end of the meeting business, just a reminder that Wednesday, March 5th, we'll be meeting at the high school, as Representative Marquardt had said, and we are adjourned.
We're done.